Chef Jim and Deborah chatted easily while I mentally balanced the ledger between pleasing my wife and contracting a terminal disease. I had to admit that his idea seemed like an easy way to start. Serve the evening meal once a week, and we'd be in and out in 3-4 hours max. We could minister from behind the rusty steel serving counter, safely separated from the customers, and we could enter and leave through the rear kitchen door, thereby minimizing contact with those likely to hit us up for money. The whole arrangement seemed like a good way for us to fulfill Deborah's desire to help the homeless without our touching them or letting them touch us. Her bright laugh pulled my attention back into the room. "I think that sounds great, Jim," she was saying. "I don't see any reason why we can't start tomorrow. In fact, let's just say you can count on us to serve every Tuesday until you hear otherwise." "Praise the Lord," Chef Jim said, this time giving Deborah a great big Baptist hug. It did not sound great to me. But Deborah had not asked me what I thought. She never did do much by committee. Driving home, she reflected aloud on how society generally regards the homeless as lazy and foolish, and maybe some were. But she felt there was so much more below that surface image. Dysfunction and addiction, yes, but also gifts like love, faith, and wisdom that lay hidden like pearls waiting only to be discovered, polished, and set. That night she dreamed about the mission again, and this time about a man. "It was like that verse in Ecclesiastes," she told me the next morning over breakfast. "A wise man who changes the city. I saw him." She gazed at me warily, as if she was afraid I wouldn't believe her, or that I might think she was losing her mind. But I knew she wasn't the dreams and visions mumbo-jumbo type. I poured fresh coffee into her cup. "You saw the man in your dream?" "Yes," she said cautiously. "I saw his face." At first, the daisy chain of wilted souls who shuffled by for their Tuesday handouts depressed me. The first in line were mamas with their children, most of whom wore stained, ill-fitting clothes and looked like someone had cut their hair with a kitchen knife. Next came a string of women, ages 18 to 85, followed by the old men, many younger than I, but with creased and haggard faces that made them look ancient. After that, the younger men, some beaten and sullen, some hiding behind a loud, false cheer meant to mask their shame. These were the ones who wandered the streets all day, then slept at the mission. Last to eat were the undiluted street people, shabby and pungent. It took me a while to get over their smell, which floated in their wake like the noxious cloud around a chemical plant. The odor seemed to stick to the hairs inside my nose. I swore I could see the hair on some of their heads rustling, jostled by hidden armies of squirming lice. A couple of the men had stumps protruding where an arm or a leg used to be. One long-haired fellow wore a necklace fashioned from several hundred cigarette butts tied together with string. He wore black plastic garbage bags tied to his belt loops. I didn't want to know what was in them. On our first day, Deborah, surveying the street people, looked at me and said, "Let's call them God's people." I was thinking they looked more like the extras in the movie Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Everyone who ate at the mission earned their free meal only after going into the chapel to sit like dead men on hard benches while a white-haired and nearly blind preacher named Brother Bill roared about the saving power of Jesus and the unpleasant consequences reserved for the unredeemed. From the kitchen side of the chapel door, locked to prevent altar call escapees, I could hear the hellfire and brimstone, tough love message that I agree often cracks hard cases. But it seemed manipulative to me, to make the hungry sit like good dogs for their supper. And it did not surprise me that even when Brother Bill split the air with one of his more rousing sermons, not a single soul ever burst through the chapel doors, waving their hands and praising Jesus. At least, not while we were there. The men and women we served seemed pleasantly surprised to have a smiling couple with all their teeth serving them supper. I'm sure they thought Deborah was on amphetamines, or possibly running for mayor, as they had likely never seen anyone who smiled and asked after them as much as she did. "I'm Deborah, and this is my husband, Ron," she'd say, as though we were welcoming visitors into her home. "What's your name?" Often she received blank stares. Some looked at her slack-jawed and goggled-eyed as though she'd just landed in the parking lot on a spaceship from Mars. Some fellows answered Deborah, though, and from that day on she was forever telling rough-looking characters with names like Butch and Killer, "Oh, what a pretty name!" Of the hundreds we served on that first day, only a handful told us what people called them. Deborah wrote down their names. Melvin, Charlie, Hal, David, Al, Jimmy, and Tiny, an affable fellow who stood 6'5", weighed 500 pounds, and wore Oshkosh overalls, fuzzy blue house slippers, and no shirt. One man, who declined to share his name, did tell us exactly what he thought of our philanthropy. Black, pencil slim, and looking wildly out of place, he wore a mauve sharkskin suit and a hustler's tie, both of which he had somehow managed to have sharply pressed. From beneath a cream-colored fedora, he surveyed his domain through dark glasses with the designer insignia stamped in gold. We later found out people called him Mister. That first Tuesday, Mister strode up to me with an aggressive, proprietary air as though the mission dining hall was his and I was trespassing. "I don't know who you folks are," he growled through an unlit filter-tipped cigar, "but you think you're doing us some kind of big favor. Well, tonight, when you and your pretty little wife are home in your three-bedroom cottage watching TV in your recliners, thinking you're better than us, you just think about this. You miss a couple of paychecks, and your wife leaves you, and you'll be homeless. Just like us." Speaking for myself, on the favor part, he was more right than I care to admit. I didn't know quite what to say. But when I opened my mouth, out came, "Thank you. Thank you for helping me see homelessness your way." Unmoved, Mister eyed me like an insect, chomped his cigar, and strode off in disgust. The encounter unnerved me some, but also gave me a peek at how some of these folks felt. A thought nibbled at the edges of my brain. Maybe my mission wasn't to analyze them, like some sort of exotic specimens, but just to get to know them. Meanwhile, no tally of disdain, strange glances, or silence seemed to bother Deborah. She wanted to know and truly serve these people, not merely feel good about herself. That first day, she fell in love with every one of them. At her urging, we memorized the names we learned that day, and that night prayed for each one, even the obstreperous Mr. Mister, whose mind I suddenly found myself hoping to change. After a couple of Tuesdays, we noticed that the only time these folks got in a hurry was when they jockeyed for position near the head of their designated section of the serving line. We found out the reason for this. They feared we might ladle out all the good stuff, meat, for example, leaving only soup or stale 7-Eleven sandwiches for those unlucky enough to have been seated at the front of the chapel farthest from the door. When the stragglers wound up with such low-end fare, the looks on their faces told a sad story. As society's throwaways, they just accepted the fact that they survived on leftovers and discards. It seemed to us such a simple thing to prepare a little more food so that the street people at the end of the line could eat as well as those who slept at the mission. So we asked Chef Jim for that favor, and he agreed. From then on, it thrilled us to serve the street people the good stuff, like fried chicken, roast beef, and spaghetti and meatballs. That was the first time I tried to do something to improve the lives of the people Deborah had dragged me along to serve. I hadn't yet touched any of them, but already they were touching me. On our third Tuesday of serving, Deborah and I were in the dining hall helping Chef Jim prepare the extra food. Blind Brother Bill had just finished preaching on forgiveness, and his congregants were filing in to eat when we heard the crash of metal and a man roaring in anger near the chapel door. Alarmed, we turned to see about 20 people scatter as a huge, angry black man hurled another chair across the dining hall floor. "I'm gonna kill whoever done it," he screamed. "I'm gonna kill whoever stole my shoes." Then he sprayed the air with a volley of curses and advanced into the crowd, roundhousing his fist at anyone stupid enough to get in his way. It looked for all the world like a gangland brawl was going to explode right there at the chapel door. As I scanned the room for mission personnel to save the day, Deborah leaned in and whispered excitedly in my ear, "That's him." "What?" I said impatiently. "What are you talking about?" "That's the man I saw in my dream. The one who changes the city. That's him." I turned and looked at Deborah as though she had truly gone over the edge. Across the room, a group of mission workers burst in and began pouring soothing words on the raging man's temper. Grudgingly, he allowed himself to be led away. "That's him," Deborah said again, eyes sparkling. "I think you should try to make friends with him." "Me?" My eyes widened in disbelief. "Did you not notice that the man you want me to make friends with just threatened to kill 20 people? She laid her hand on my shoulder and tilted her head with a smile. "I really think God's laid it on my heart that you need to reach out to him." "Sorry," I said, trying hard to ignore the head tilt. "But I wasn't at that meeting when you heard from God." I wasn't about to invite a killer out for tea. But we did start tracking the man Deborah said she had seen in her dream. He intrigued us both. Probably in his 60s, he looked younger and somehow older at the same time. He dressed in rags, a loner. The whites of his eyes had gone an eerie yellow. He never smiled and seldom spoke. Nor did we see anyone acknowledge him. But it wasn't as though others at the mission ostracized him. It was more like they kept a respectful distance, as one might give wide berth to a pit bull. On Tuesdays, when the serving line had nearly dried up, he would suddenly appear out of nowhere. With a poker face and no eye contact, he'd indicate that he wanted two plates, claiming one was for an old man upstairs. It was a clear violation of the rules, but we weren't there to be the mission police. So we served him double and blessed him, to which he responded with a wall of silence. One Tuesday, someone in the kitchen told us they thought his name was Dallas. Dallas always ate one plate in the dining hall, picking out a spot in a corner far from other human contact. If anyone dared to sit nearby, he got up and moved. While eating, he stared sternly into his plate, chewing slowly with his few good teeth. Never glancing left or right, he methodically scooped the food into his mouth until it was gone. Then he would vanish. I mean that, vanish. He had this strange knack. You rarely saw him come or go. It was more like he was there, and then he was. Often, driving up to the mission, we'd see Dallas standing alone in a parking lot across the street in the shadow of a dumpster, his face a stone slate. A couple of times I overheard people saying this loner was crazy and not to mess with him. Deborah wrote his name in her Bible, next to Ecclesiastes 9:15. There was found in a certain city a poor man who was wise, and by his wisdom he saved the city. Occasionally, Deborah reminded me that she had a feeling God wanted me to be Dallas's friend, but I wasn't looking for any new friends, and even if I had been, Dallas from Fort Worth did not fit the profile. Still, only to please Deborah, God would have to wait, I began a gingerly pursuit of the man. "Hey there, Dallas," I'd say whenever I saw him. "How are you doing today?" Most of the time he ignored me, but sometimes his yellowing eyes skewered me with a look that said, "Leave me alone," which I would have been only too happy to do had it not been for my wife. After a couple of months of this, someone at the mission heard me call Dallas, Dallas, and laughed at me like I was the town idiot. "His name ain't Dallas, fool. It's Denver." Well, maybe that's why he looks disgusted every time I speak to him, I thought, suddenly hopeful. "Hey, Denver," I called the very next time I saw him out by the dumpster. He never even looked at me. The man was about as approachable as an electric counterfeit.
Chapter 19. Things was going along just fine at the mission till that smiling white couple started serving in the dining hall on Tuesdays. Every week that woman drew a bead on me in the serving line. She'd smile at me real big and ask me my name and how I was doing. You know, attacking me for no particular reason. I did my best to stay completely out of her way. And I didn't tell her my name was Denver, neither. But some fool blowed my cover. After that, the woman would corner me and poke her little skinny finger in my face and tell me I wasn't no bad fella. "Denver, God has a calling on your life," she'd say. I told her several times not to be messing with me, 'cause I was a mean man. "You are not a mean man, and I don't ever want to hear you say that," she'd say. She was getting kind of smart with me. Ain't never been no woman done that before. And few men either, without them getting hurt. But she kept on attacking me until I thought to myself, "What did I ever do to this woman that she won't leave me alone so I can go on about my business?" It might seem like being homeless don't take no skill, but I'm going to tell you, to stay alive, homeless folks has got to know who's who and what's what. Here's what the homeless in Fort Worth knowed about me. Stay out of my way, 'cause I would beat a man down, have him snoring before he hit the ground. But no matter how mean and bad I tried to act at the mission, I couldn't shake that woman loose. She was the first person I'd met in a long time that wasn't scared of me. Seemed like to me She had spiritual eyes. She could see right through my skin to who I was on the inside. Let me tell you what homeless people think about folks that help homeless people. When you homeless, you wonder why certain volunteers do what they do. What do they want? Everybody wants something. For instance, when that couple come to the mission, I thought the man looked like the law, the way he dressed, the way he acted, too high class. His wife, too, at first. The way she acted, the way she treated people, she just looked too sophisticated. Wasn't the way she dressed. It was just something about the way she carried herself. And both of them was asking way too many questions. While everybody else was falling in love with them, I was what you call skeptical. I wasn't thinking nothing evil. It was just that they didn't look like the type to come in and mess with the homeless. People like that may not feel it within themselves that they're better than you. But when you the one that's homeless, you feel like they feel they're better than you. But these folks was different. One reason was they didn't come just on holidays. Most people don't want the homeless close to them. Think they're dirty or got some kind of disease. Or maybe they think that kind of troubled life gonna rub off on them. They come at Christmas and Easter and Thanksgiving and give you a little turkey and lukewarm gravy. Then they go home and gather around their own table and forget about you till the next time come around when they start feeling a little guilty because they got so much to be thankful for. On Tuesdays, I started waiting till there wasn't no line so I could get through real fast without talking to that couple at all. But that didn't mean I wasn't watching them.
Chapter 20. It took a couple of months before I noticed a real change in my heart, a heart that was feeling like it had been run through the short cycle in a microwave, warm on the outside, but still a little cool in the middle. I was fairly certain something had happened when I began waking up on Tuesday morning, mission day, and felt the same chill of excitement as when I woke up on Saturdays at Rocky Top. It wasn't a raising the dead caliber miracle or anything, but folks who knew me would have classified it as a minor one, at least. My own take on the topic was that maybe, just maybe, God had also rung my number when he called Deborah. On days when nothing else pressed, I'd found myself dropping by the mission. Soon the fellows in the hood started to recognize my dirty green crew cab truck. And when they saw me pop out of the tunnel on East Lancaster Street, they'd slip their paper bag-wrapped liquor bottles behind their bags and wave at me like I was a neighbor coming home from work. Sometimes I ventured into the streets, places where, even in broad daylight, young women wandered by like death in blue jeans, offering sex for cigarettes, or for a ride home to steal Mama's TV and pawn it at Cash America. I hoped just to lend an ear, be an example. Sometimes I stayed closer to the mission where some sunny afternoons I'd sit on a curb in the shade of a vacant building and chat. One fellow told me he'd been married 1,000 times to 1,000 beautiful women, all of them as rich as Oprah. Of course, he said, all of them had also stolen every dime he'd ever made. So he asked me if I could spare a smoke. If I hung around long enough and concentrated on spotting a fellow who didn't want to be spotted, I'd nearly always see Denver. But if I made a move toward him, he would move an equal distance away. The fact that I was now calling him by his real name seemed to do more harm than good. If anything, he seemed irritated, like he was mad that I now had it right. The mission residents had by then dubbed Deborah Mrs. Tuesday. They liked her a lot. But she became convinced that it would take more than like, and more than our ladling macaroni and meatloaf to gain their trust. Without that, she realized, our efforts might mean a full belly on Tuesday nights, but little in the way of real change. Her goal was changed lives, healed hearts, broken men and women rejoining the ranks of the clean and sober, moving out to places of their own, spending Sundays in the park with their family. She began to rack her brain about ways to bring a little joy into their lives. Her first idea? Beauty shop night. Deborah and her best friend, Mary Ellen Davenport, would go to the mission loaded down with makeup kits, hairstyling tools, perfumes, soaps, and every manicure and pedicure accessory ever invented. And the homeless women would come. Deborah and Mary Ellen would comb the lice out of their hair, then wash and style it with blow dryers and curling tools. If a woman wanted a pedicure, Deborah and Mary Ellen would wash her feet, use pumice stones to scrub away calluses, layered on by ill-fitting shoes, and paint her toenails in a feminine shade of red or pink. They did facials and makeovers and gave the women little makeup kits to keep. Sometimes on these nights, a homeless woman, catching a glimpse of herself in a mirror, would remember what she looked like before her life went off course and begin to cry. Then Deborah dreamed up movie night. It sounded silly to me, but on the first night, at least 50 men showed up to watch a movie about the Brooklyn Tabernacle Choir. The next Wednesday, the dining hall was completely packed, 150 people. The third week, something miraculous happened. Instead of heading for the exits when the video screen went blank, grown men, crusty and battle-hardened, began weeping and asking for prayer. God somehow managed to transform the dining hall into a confessional. It wasn't the movies that caused the metamorphosis. It was just the simple act of caring. The men began confiding in us things some of them had never told anyone, and truthfully, some things I wish they'd never told us. That spurred Deborah on to a new idea, birthday night. Once a month, we brought a giant, gorgeously frosted sheet cake, and everyone, including God's people, would be invited to eat some. Those with the birthday that month got two pieces. Some folks couldn't even remember what month they were born, but we weren't checking IDs. The cake was always a hit, so much so that people began having more and more birthdays, it seemed. Some every month. During the 12 months we brought cake, some fellows at the mission aged 12 years. In the fall of 1998, the mailman delivered to our home an invitation that arrived with the junk mail but turned out to be a treasure. Our friend, Tim Taylor, was organizing an outreach to the unreached. That's fancy talk for evangelism. In the downtown theater that occupied the top floor of a landmark bar called the Caravan of Dreams, Deborah and I had been to the Caravan, a smoky jazz and blues lounge owned by billionaire developer and Fort Worth renovator Ed Bass. But the bar had stayed hip while we had not, so it had been years since we'd dropped in. Still, Tim's invitation gave Deborah an idea. We could drive down to the mission and pack our cars with people who would enjoy a liquor-free night on the town. Given Jesus' habit of consorting with drinkers and gluttons, she didn't see the venue as a problem. The next day, we whipped up a flyer announcing the free concert, drove down to the mission, and tacked it up on a bulletin board next to one offering to buy poor people's plasma. The flyer didn't say what band was playing, but the Caravan was no hole in the wall. Anyone who'd been in Fort Worth a while knew it occasionally featured a marquee performer. I'm sure the mission folks were hoping B.B. King might show up. Rain slicked the pavement as we pulled up to the mission that evening, me in my Suburban and Deborah in her Land Cruiser. Still, we had customers, about 15 men and women standing on the shiny sidewalk dressed in their handout best, including Denver. We were shocked to see him standing on the mission steps, solemn and rigid like the statue of a dictator, and he clearly meant to go with us. He was scrubbed so clean, his ebony skin shone against a dark blue second-hand suit that almost fit. He stood alone, of course, at least 20 feet from anyone, which did not surprise us, since the others always treated him like a bad dog on a long chain. When I got out and opened the door to my Suburban, 6 men piled into the 2 back seats, leaving the front passenger seat vacant. No one wanted to sit near Denver, who had sourly observed the commotion of loading, yet had not made a move. For 5 solid minutes he stood there staring. I waited. Then, without a word, he stalked to the Suburban and slid into the front seat, inches from my elbow. I had never been that close to him. I felt like Billy Crystal in the movie City Slickers, when he camps alone on the prairie with the menacing trail boss, Curly, shivering as Curly sharpens his knife on a razor strop. To break the tension, I took a couple of stabs at trivial conversation, but Denver sat stock still and silent, a sphinx riding shotgun. As I eased down the street, the other fellows seemed happy to be riding in a car that wasn't marked Fort Worth Police Department on the sides. They wanted to know all about it, the monthly payments and whether I knew any of the rich people. Deborah followed in her Land Cruiser with a carload of ladies. In 5 minutes we were through the tunnel and at the caravan. We both parked, and our guests spilled out, chattering and laughing, glad to be dressed up and in the other Fort Worth. We all paraded in up the stairs to the theater, where 250 seats sloped toward a small stage. Except for Denver, I was acutely aware he had not come in. Everyone was seated, and the show was about to begin, but I got up and went back downstairs. I found him standing on the sidewalk, puffing on a cigarette. "The concert's about to start," I said. "Don't you want to come in?" Smoke curled up around his dark head. I heard the spat-spat of rain off the eaves. Denver said nothing. I posted myself just inside the caravan door and waited. Finally, he walked past me and up the stairs, as if I were no more alive than a cigar store Indian. I followed, and when he took an end seat on a row by himself, I sat down next to him. Then I did something stupid. I smiled heartily and patted him on the knee. "Denver, I'm glad you came." He didn't smile back, didn't even blink, just stood up and walked away. At first, I was afraid to turn around, but later, as the concert began, I saw him out of the corner of my eye, sitting on the back row, alone. That tore it. "He's a nutcase," I concluded. "Not worth my trouble. The man was definitely looking a gift horse in the mouth." Another thought nagged at me, though. Could it possibly be something he saw in me? Something he didn't like? Maybe he felt like the target of a blow-dried white hunter searching for a trophy to show off to friends, one he bagged after a grueling 4-month safari in the inner city. Meanwhile, if I caught him, what would I do with him? Maybe God and Deborah had gotten their signals crossed. Maybe I wasn't supposed to be his friend. The concert lasted a little less than 2 hours. Afterward, as we skirted shallow rain puddles on the way back to the cars, our guest thanked us profusely, all except for Denver, who hung back as usual. But when all the others had piled back in the cars, he walked up to me and spoke the first words I had ever heard come out of his mouth outside the dining hall. "I want to apologize to you," he said. "You and your wife been trying to be nice to me for some time now, and I have purposely avoided you. I'm sorry. Stunned, I didn't know what to say, and didn't want to say too much for fear he'd bolt again, so all I said was, "That's okay. Next time you is at the mission, try and find me, and let's have a cup of coffee and chat a little bit." "What about tomorrow morning?" was what came out when I opened my over-eager yap. "I'll pick you up, and we'll have breakfast together. How about me taking you to your favorite restaurant, and I'll treat?" "I ain't got no favorite restaurant," he said. Then added, "Matter of fact, I don't think I ever been to no restaurant." "Well, then, I'll choose one, and pick you up at 8:30, same place I drop you off." We climbed back into the Suburban, and I sped back to the mission. I couldn't wait to tell Denver the news.
Chapter 21. Like I said, I've been watching Mr. and Mrs. Tuesday. They wasn't like the holiday volunteers. They come every week and talk to the homeless folks and not seem to be afraid of them. Talk to them like they was intelligent. I started to think Mr. and Mrs. Tuesday might be trying to do some real good instead of just making themselves feel better about being rich. So when they started talking something about going down to the Caravan of Dreams, that got me interested. There was a lot of folks at the mission that respected me. I thought if I went, that might encourage some other folks to go too. Besides that, I had lived downtown before the millionaires started fixing it up. I had seen a lot of them new buildings, and I thought I might like to go down there and check it out. By that time, I had me a job working in the clothing store at the mission. It wasn't nothing but a warehouse that seemed 100 years old, with boxes of clothes and shoes and such stacked up near as high as the light bulbs hanging naked from the ceiling. When I heard about this trip to the Caravan, I grabbed the best suit that come through there that day, picked it out special. To tell you the truth, though, I was kind of hoping the cars would be full up. Then I wouldn't have to go. You know how it is when you're trying to do the right thing, even though you really don't want to do it. Well, just my luck, God saved me a seat. All them men loaded themselves into the big Suburban, and which seat you think they left? The front one, right next to Mr. Tuesday. I just stood up on the steps, waiting and hoping somebody else would come out of the mission. Late and wanted to go to the Caravan instead of me. Well, that didn't happen, so I got in the car. Next thing I was hoping was that Mr. Tuesday wouldn't say nothing to me. But that was about like hoping the sun wouldn't come up, and of course, he started right in. And then at the Caravan, not only would he not let me go on about my business, he had to haul off and put his hand on my knee. I guess he didn't know I had knocked men out for less. I didn't want him by me. I didn't want nobody by me. I wanted to be by myself. So I got up and burned off. That was just my way. But after a while, I started feeling kind of bad about that. I've been watching Mr. and Mrs. Tuesday, and I know they were serious about helping folks. It would have been kind of ugly of me not to tell them I appreciated it. So after the concert let out, I waited for everybody to get in the cars. Then I edged over to Mr. Tuesday and apologized. He said that was okay. Then I said, maybe we could have some coffee at the mission. Lord have mercy, did that open up a can of worms.
Chapter 22. After the Caravan concert, I got back to the mission first, exchanging thank yous and good nights. I dropped off the mission men curbside, speed dialing Deborah's cell phone as I pulled away. "You're not going to believe this," I said when she picked up. "He talked to me." "Who?" she said. "I can barely hear you." I could hear the mission women still chattering in the background. "Denver." "What?" "Denver. He came up to me after the concert and apologized for running away from us all this time. And guess what? Tomorrow, I'm taking him out to breakfast." "I knew it," Deborah said. "I knew you'd make friends with him." She was elated. Before we went to bed that night, we prayed together that God would show us how to reach Denver, how to let him know we cared about him. Still, before I left the next morning, I warned Deborah not to get her hopes up. When I pulled up to the mission at 8:30 sharp, Denver was waiting for me on the steps. It was the second time I had seen him neatly dressed, and the second day in a row, this time in khaki trousers and a white shirt with a button-down collar he hadn't buttoned. We exchanged greetings and drove with little small talk to the Cactus Flower Cafe, a little place I like on Throckmorton. Denver ordered eggs and grits and buttermilk, and when the waitress said they didn't have buttermilk, I silently thanked God. When I was little, watching my dad gulp down the clabbered chunks made me gag. The food came, followed by a lesson in patience. I was half done by the time Denver finished melting butter on his grits. I was mopping up egg yolk with my biscuit before he had taken his first bite. It took him a solid hour to eat two eggs and grits. I swear I wanted to snatch his fork away and feed him myself. I did most of the talking, of course, asking about his family without getting too personal, a policy he reciprocated in his answers, in a quiet country drawl, sometimes laughing and sometimes choosing his words with great caution. He sketched scenes of his past. I learned that he had been raised on a Louisiana plantation, that he'd never been to school a day in his life, and that somewhere in his late 20s, he wasn't quite sure when, he'd hopped a freight train with less than $20 in his pocket. He had been homeless and in and out of scrapes with the law ever since. Suddenly, Denver dropped his head and became silent. "What is it?" I said, concerned I might have pushed too hard. He raised his head and stared into my eyes, his own, like brown lasers, locked on target. In my mind, I started counting to 100 and was past 80 when he finally spoke. "Mind if I ask you a personal question?" he said. "Of course not. Ask me anything you want." "I don't want to make you mad, and you don't have to tell me nothing if you don't want to." "Ask away," I said, and braced myself. Again a long pause, then softly, "What's your name?" "What's my name? That's what you wanted to ask me?" "Yes, sir," he ventured, embarrassment creeping up his cheeks. "In the circle I live in, you don't ask nobody his name." Suddenly I flashed back to the slack-jawed stares we'd encountered on our first day at the mission. "You don't ask nobody his name." "Ron Hall," I blurted, smiling. "Mr. Ron," Denver replied, translating plantation style. "No, just Ron." "No, it's Mr. Ron," he repeated firmly. "What's your wife's name?" "Deborah. Miss Debbie," he said warmly. "I think she's an angel." "Me too," I said. "She just might be one." His obvious affection for her touched me, especially because he had never really acknowledged her. Now, I thought I knew why. If he'd opened up to her, he'd blow his cover, and that would threaten his survival in the jungle where he was the lion and everyone feared him. I knew after listening to his story that he'd carved out a life for himself, though meager and pathetic from the perspective of the more fortunate. It was a life he knew how to live. After more than 30 years, he was an expert at it. God may have been calling Denver, as Deborah had been telling him, but in Denver's view, maybe God should have come knocking earlier. By the time he'd finished his breakfast, my hair had grown an inch. I sensed he wasn't through talking, but I wasn't sure what else to say. Finally, he asked me a pointed question. What you want from me? A direct hit, I thought, and decided to give him a completely unvarnished answer. I just want to be your friend. He raised his eyebrows in curious disbelief, and a long moment of silence stretched between us. Let me think about it, he finally said. I didn't feel rejected, which surprised me. Then again, I had never formally asked anyone to be my friend. I paid the bill. Denver thanked me. As we rode back to the mission, he began to laugh. I didn't really get the joke, but his laugh turned into a roar, so robust that tears appeared in the corners of his eyes, and he began to choke like he'd swallowed a frog and couldn't catch his breath. After a block or so, I started laughing, too, at first because I was afraid not to, then naturally as his genuine mirth became contagious. Folks at the mission, he sputtered, still chuckling and wiping at his eyes. Folks at the mission thinks you and your wife is from the CIA. The CIA? Yes, sir. The CIA. Is that what you thought, too? Yes, he said, finally able to collect himself. Most folks that serve at the mission come once or twice, and we never see them again. But you and your wife come every week. And your wife always be asking everybody his name and his birthday, you know, gathering information. Now, just think about it. Why would anybody be wanting to know a homeless man's name and birthday if they ain't the CIA? A week passed before I saw Denver again on a brilliant fall day. The sky a crisp blue. Sweater weather. Cruising down East Lancaster in the crew cab, I spotted him standing stone-like by the dumpster across the street from the mission. Gone was the pressed and proper cleaned-up man we had taken to the show. Denver had slipped back into his comfort zone as a vagrant. I pulled to the curb and lowered the passenger side window. Hop in. Let's go get a cup of coffee. I steered toward the Starbucks at University, a mall designed by Charles Hodges, an eminent Dallas-Fort Worth architect and a friend of mine. Instead of gargoyles along the eaves, he'd installed replicas of the skulls of longhorn steers. Vintage Texas. At first, Denver was quiet as we stood in line, and I found out later he was amazed that people would stand in line to pay $2 or $3 for a cup of coffee that had to be ordered in a foreign language. On top of that, he got worried that the folks working the cash register were getting ready to mix it up with the folks brewing the coffee. He elbowed me and whispered fiercely, "There's fixing to be a rumble." "A rumble?" "Yeah, 'cause of all that back-talking they doing. One says decaf non-fat latte, and the other one hollers it back, and another one hollers frappe, and somebody else hollers back frappe. That's a gang talk. That kind of back-talking gets you killed on the streets." He looked genuinely concerned. I tried explaining the strange cafe language that seemed to have taken over the civilized world. Then we took our coffee outside and pulled up chairs at a tiny black patio table under a green umbrella. For a few minutes, I attempted to explain what an art dealer is to a man who had never heard of Picasso. When I launched off on a tangent about French Impressionism, he appeared thoroughly unimpressed. Then, down my board. I finally figured out he wasn't listening and stopped my patter. Then things got quiet. Denver was first to break the silence. "What's your name again?" "Ron." "And what's your wife's name?" "Deborah." "Mr. Ron and Miss Debbie," he said, allowing a smile to escape. "I'll try to remember." Then his smile faded into seriousness, as if he had a rare light moment. Then someone had closed the blinds. He stared down at the steam rolling up from his coffee cup. "I've been thinking a lot about what you asked me." I had no idea what he was talking about. What did I ask you? "About being your friend." My jaw dropped an inch. I'd forgotten that when I told him at the Cactus Flower Cafe that all I wanted from him was his friendship, he'd said he'd think about it. Now I was shocked that anyone would spend a week pondering such a question. While the whole conversation had slipped my mind, Denver had clearly spent serious time preparing his answer. He looked up from his coffee, fixing me with one eye. The other squinted like Clint Eastwood. "There's something I heard about white folks that bothers me, and it has to do with fishing." He was serious, and I didn't dare laugh, but I did try to lighten the mood a bit. "I don't know if I'll be able to help you. I don't even own a tackle box." Denver scowled, not amused. "I think you can." He spoke slowly and deliberately, keeping me pinned with that eyeball, ignoring the Starbucks groupies coming and going on the patio around us. "I heard that when white folks go fishing, they do something called catch and release." "Catch and release?" I nodded solemnly, suddenly nervous and curious at the same time. "That really bothers me," Denver went on. "I just can't figure it out. 'Cause when colored folks go fishing, we're really proud of what we catch, and we take it and show it off to everybody that'll look. Then we eat what we catch. In other words, we use it to sustain us. So it really bothers me that white folks will go to all that trouble to catch a fish, then when they done caught it, just throw it back in the water." He paused again, and the silence between us stretched a full minute. Then, "Did you hear what I said?" I nodded, afraid to speak, afraid to offend. Denver looked away, searching the blue autumn sky, then locked onto me again with that drill-bit stare. "So, Mr. Ron, it occurred to me if you was fishing for a friend, you're just going to catch and release, then I ain't got no desire to be your friend." The world seemed to halt in mid-stride and fall silent around us like one of those freeze-frame scenes on TV. I could hear my heart pounding and imagined Denver could see it popping my breast pocket up and down. I returned Denver's gaze with what I hoped was a receptive expression and hung on. Suddenly, his eyes gentled, and he spoke more softly than before. "But if you was looking for a real friend, then I'll be one forever."
Chapter 23. I'm going to tell you right now what I first thought about Mr. Ron asking me would I be his friend. I didn't like it. Why would he want to be my friend? That's what I was thinking. What does he want? Everybody wants something. Why don't he pick on somebody else? Why I got to be his friend? You got to understand that by that time, I had layers of street on me a mile thick. Some homeless folks got lots of friends, but I had never had let nobody get that close. It wasn't that I was worried about him getting hurt or nothing like that. Being a friend is a heavy commitment, in a way, even more than a husband or wife. And I was selfish. I could take care of myself, and I didn't need nobody else's baggage. Besides that, friendship, to me, means more than just somebody to talk to or run with or hang with. Being friends is like being soldiers in the army. You live together. You fight together. You die together. I knowed Mr. Ron wasn't fixing to come up out of no bushes and help me fight. But then I got to thinking about him some more and thought maybe we might have something to offer each other. I could be his friend in a different way than he could be my friend. I knowed he wanted to help the homeless, and I could take him places he couldn't go by himself. I didn't know what I might find in his circle, or even that I had any business being there, but I knowed he could help me find out whatever was down that road. The way I looked at it, a fair exchange ain't no robbery, and even a swap ain't no swindle. He was going to protect me in the country club, and I was going to protect him in the hood. Even swap straight down the line.
Chapter 24. If you was looking for a real friend, then I'll be one. Forever. As Denver's words echoed in my head, it occurred to me that I could not recall ever having heard any pronouncement on friendship more moving or profound than what I just heard from the mouth of a vagabond. Humbled, all I could do in return was make a simple but sincere promise. Denver, if you'll be my friend, I promise not to catch and release. He put out his hand and we shook. Then, like a sunrise, a grin lit Denver's face, and we stood facing each other and hugged. In that moment, the fear and distrust that had hulked like an iceberg between us melted on the warm patio outside Starbucks. Beginning that day, we became the new odd couple, Denver and I. A couple of times a week, I'd swing by the mission and pick him up, and we'd head out to a coffee house, a museum, or a cafe. Deborah, meanwhile, urged me on, praying deep roots for the friendship she'd prayed would bud in the first place. After our catch-and-release chat, Denver's sulking silence thawed into a gentle shyness. "Did you see how Denver said hi in the supper line?" she'd say, eyes shining. "I think you're really making progress." No longer just Mr. and Mrs. Tuesday, Deborah and I began going to the mission even more often. She'd stay and work with the women and children while Denver and I went somewhere to hang out. If I planned to take him to a nice restaurant, I'd call ahead to the mission to give him time to slip into his preppy disguise. If we were going to Starbucks, though, he dressed to his own liking. Usually, that meant conspicuously poor. Soiled shirt, buttoned crooked, holy pants, and beaten-up leather shoes he wore like house slides, his heels smashing down the backs. It was at Starbucks that I learned about 20th-century slavery. Not the slavery of auction blocks, of young blacks led away in ropes and chains. Instead, it was a slavery of debt bondage. Poverty, ignorance, and exploitation. A slavery in which the man, of whom Denver's man was only one among many, held all the cards and dealt them mostly from the bottom of the deck, the way his daddy had taught him, and his granddaddy before that. More than half a century before Denver was born, Abraham Lincoln had formally declared that all persons held as slaves within said designated states and parts of states are, and henceforward shall be, free. That was all well and fine, but white plantation owners did not go quietly into the night. First, southern state houses passed black codes, laws that used legal tricks to keep black people slaves, forcing the federal government to break up the state legislatures and put the army in charge of the stubborn South. After state lawmakers promised to try to be good, planters and the people they once owned tried a new arrangement, sharecropping. That turned out to be a devil's bargain. Not only did sharecropping spawn poverty and hopelessness among both blacks and poor whites, it also opened up an ugly, festering crack in the plantation South into which people like Denver Moore fell, some forever. That fissure ran through Red River Parish, where Denver's man was a shrewd dealer. Not wanting to lose his labor supply, he kept the aces to himself. He dealt the card of meager sustenance, but withheld the card of American progress. He dealt the card of backbreaking labor, but withheld the card of education. The get-out-of-jail-free card that would have liberated men like Denver. In the 20th century, slaves were free to leave the plantation, but their debt and lack of education kept them shackled to the man. I listened to Denver's story with 50-year-old ears that had been touched by the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King. Later, I found out that the Ku Klux Klan in Coushatta, Louisiana, a town in Red River Parish, had once plotted to assassinate Dr. King. The FBI had wanted to swoop in and foil the plot, but J. Edgar Hoover refused to let them. The more I learned, the more I hated the man and wanted to right the wrongs of Louisiana's modern-day slave masters. I sang Denver's story like a songbird to anyone who would listen. Then one day, a thought hit me like a right cross to the head. My own granddaddy had not been so much different from the man. Fairer, yes, an honest and decent man in the Texas of his day, but the wages he paid were still no excuse for the pitiful way we treated the folks who worked his land. Amazingly, though, Denver kept telling me that a man providing jobs has a right to earn a profit. Denver had lived in an unplumbed two-room shack with no glass in the windows nearly until the time his country put men on the moon. But he still maintained that the man wasn't really a bad fellow. He was just doing what he was raised up to do, Denver said. Besides, if everybody was rich, who gonna do the work? That kind of homespun, practical way of looking at things hooked me. After our catch-and-release conversation, I gave him my phone number and told him where we lived, breaking a cardinal rule for mission volunteers. The truth is, prior to my Starbucks fishing lesson, I never thought Denver and I would form a real friendship, at least not one carried on outside his neighborhood. I hate to admit this now, but I had pictured myself more as a sort of indulgent benefactor. I would give him a little bit of my valuable time, which, had I not been so benevolent, I could have used to make a few more $1,000s. And from time to time, I imagined if Denver stayed cleaned up and sober, I'd take him on field trips from Hobo Land to restaurants and malls, a kind of peep show where he could glimpse the fruit of responsible living and perhaps change his ways accordingly. I was aware I might cause him some therapeutic torment over the fact that he would probably never own some of the high-end toys we had, like a horse trailer with sleeping quarters. He would certainly never own a ranch or a painting by Picasso. I was amazed when that didn't bother him a bit, especially not the Picasso part, after Denver saw some of his work. One afternoon, we visited three art museums, the Kimball, the Amon Carter, and the Modern. At the Modern, he thought I was playing a joke on him. As we viewed one of Picasso's less, shall we say, organized works, Denver looked at me as if the museum curators were trying to pass off some kind of snake oil. "You're just kidding me, right?" he said. "Folks ain't really calling this art, is they?" I decorated my own house with similar works, and as an art dealer, the Modern masters were my niche. But as we strolled through the Modern that day, I tried to look through his eyes at the bold geometrics, splashed paints, and huge canvases dominated by negative space. I had to admit, some of it could be construed as junk. The Kimball was Denver's favorite. Old master paintings drew him like magnets, especially those that were centuries old and depicted Christ. When we stopped in front of a large Matisse from the 1940s and I told him it cost $12 million, his mouth fell open. "Well," he said, eyeing the work in dubious wonder, "I don't like it much, but I'm glad the museum bought it so somebody like me could see what a $12 million picture looks like." He paused and then added, "You think if the guards knowed I was homeless, they'd let me in here?" With the museums, the restaurants, and the malls, I was showing Denver a different way to live, a side of life in which people took time to appreciate fine things, where they talked about ideas, where raw yellowtail cost more than cooked catfish. But he remained absolutely convinced that his way of life was no worse than mine, only different, pointing out in the process certain inconsistencies. Why, he wondered, did rich people call it sushi, while poor people called it bait? I knew Denver was sincere when he told me that he would not want to trade places with me for even one day. His convictions became clear to me when I laid my key ring on the table between us at one of our earliest meetings for coffee. Denver smiled a bit and sidled up to a cautious question. "I know it ain't none of my business, but does you own something that each one of them keys fits?" I glanced at the keys. There were about 10 of them. "I suppose," I replied, not really ever having thought about it. "Are you sure you own them, or does they own you?" That wisdom stuck to my brain like duct tape. The more I thought about it, the more I became convinced. We'd enjoy life a whole lot more if we owned a whole lot less. In some ways, Denver became the professor and I the student, as he shared his particular brand of spiritual insight and plain old country wisdom. I also came to realize that though his 30 years on the streets had sown a thick hide on the man, they had also forged in him staunch loyalty, a strong spirit, and a deep understanding of what beats in the heart of the downtrodden. Though wallowing in the sin and addictions of street life, he claimed in his solitude to have heard from God. His brain had filed away everything he had seen over the years, and it seemed he had just been waiting for someone willing to listen. I was privileged to be the first to lend an ear.
Chapter 25. Me and Mr. Ron started spending a fair amount of time together. Me taking him out into the hood to show him what's what, and him taking me to museums and restaurants and cafes and such. I learned a lot on those trips, like the difference between a taco and an enchilada. The taco is the crunchy thing, and the enchilada is that long thing that kind of flops down beside the taco. I usually just eat the inside of taco, though, because I ain't got that many good teeth. I also found out the difference between a restaurant and a cafe. A restaurant is where they roll your fork and your knife up in a fancy towel that you use for a napkin. In a cafe, you just have a regular old paper napkin, and ain't nothing rolled up in it usually. First time Mr. Ron